Hello, and welcome to the AgTech So What podcast. Emerging technologies are rapidly changing the global agricultural industry, and we believe that this revolution is only getting started. But there's still too much hype out there and too big of a disconnect between ag and ag tech. So on this show, we try to bridge that gap. In each episode, we bring you the story of a different innovator in agriculture and try to find the place where ag and tech meet. I'm your host, Sarah Nolette. Today's episode is a live recording from the Sydney AgTech Meetup, which we run in partnership with SproutX. A big thanks to the team at Grow Love Project who recorded and produced this episode. My guest is Dan Harburg. Dan is a senior director with Indigo Ag, and Indigo is one of AgTech's biggest startups. They've raised over $650 million, have over 1,000 staff, and are working to expand in the U.S. and internationally. Dan was visiting Australia to learn more about carbon farming and the work that's happening here that might be helpful to Indigo and farmers around the world. You'll hear my chat with Dan and then the Q&A from audience at the end. We start with Dan telling us how he came to work at Indigo.
I come from a technical background. I did a PhD in electrical engineering, actually, and started exploring opportunities for technology to transform new industries. And one of the first companies that I helped start was a robotics company that ended up doing quite a bit of work in the food and agriculture sector, a company called Soft Robotics that's also based in Boston. And in that company, we were developing a brand new way to grip products very delicately. And we started getting invited by agricultural producers around the world to come look at production facilities, processing plants, and more go into the field and think about how we could automate harvesting operations. And I got really interested in exploring the food and ag space and seeing all these opportunities for new tech to come to an industry that hasn't seen a lot of the digital transformations that have happened in other places. And so through that experience and then some time spent working with a venture capital fund, helping them explore how digital technologies could transform this industry, I found Indigo and joined about a year ago.
So I've heard that Indigo has gone from something like 300 people 18 months ago to over 1,000 now. When did you join?
I signed at a point that we were like 350 and they had already grown to almost 500 by the time that I joined, like in between when I signed my offer letter. And now we're over 1,000, as you said. So it's been amazing to see how quickly the offices have expanded in Boston and in Memphis, where really the biggest growth is happening, but now more and more here in Australia, as well as South America. We just opened an office in Europe as well. So we have some folks based in Switzerland now, too.
So how many of you in the audience could say you know what Indigo does? Five, six? Okay, good. So let's...
Glad to see Bill's hand. Yes. I really appreciate it.
And it's great to have Bill in the audience. Bill runs the Australian operations for Indigo, so maybe some questions will get thrown to him later, just as a heads up. So tell us what Indigo does, and I think that is probably a temporal story. You might have to start out with what you guys started doing and maybe where you're up to now.
Sure. So our mission is to help farmers harness nature to sustainably feed the planet. So we started as a company based in Boston, you know, the home of many biotech companies around the world, with a simple insight that was inside of every human, there's a microbiome inside of your gut that helps you deal with the stresses that you come under every day. And we've known now for the past decade or so that modifying that microbiome and tuning it in the right ways can help improve human health drastically. The same thing is true of plants. So a plant has a series of microbes inside of it, as well as the microbes in the soil, but microbes that help it deal with stresses. And so when you go into fields that have experienced significant stresses, you'll often find that some plants will endure while others die. And that can be because of the microbial composition, the community that's inside of those plants. And so Indigo set out on a mission about 5 years ago to try to explore those microbial populations and see if we could essentially put the good microbes into plants that didn't have them and help a whole population advance so that you could reduce chemistry and other inputs and maximize grower profits in the same way. So we started as a company in that direction. We realized as we started selling a microbially treated seed product to growers that, you know, it's hard to transition from the seeds that you buy as a grower today. And also the opportunity for differentiating your product and then selling it into the market is extremely unique. And if you can do that in the right way, you can truly shift the profitability of the grower quite drastically. And you might actually be able to start to decommoditize some of these large commodity grain and fiber industries that exist around the world today, where if a grower uses 20% less nitrogen in their operation, today there's no way for them to get any more credit from that other than it might reduce their input costs. But if, you know, a consumer could be extremely interested in that, or a buyer of wheat might be very interested in the protein content of grain, but they have very little opportunity to directly interact with the provider of that grain. And so as we started exploring these areas, we realized that there was a huge opportunity on the crop marketing side, not just the production side, but in helping growers deliver these commodity grains directly to people who cared about the way that they grew them. So Indigo has expanded to try to help with crop production, help with agronomy in the field, and then help growers market their grain in new ways.
And you guys are also involved in the ag tech space now and with the Terraton Initiative, so I want to talk about both of those. Yeah. But I guess before I do, I want to talk a little bit about Australia and what you guys are doing here in that microbe space. And one of the things we were chatting about before is that Indigo has kind of been doing a few things in Australia with, I would say, mixed results perhaps. And one of the insights is maybe that some of the microbes in the U.S. that have worked there don't work here, and that it's quite a different environment here. So I would love for you to tell the Australian audience kind of what's happening here, what has happened, and what are your kind of activities in Australia?
Microbes are a challenging product for many reasons. If you think about the core opportunities that we went after as a company as we started to develop microbes, they were for things like drought-stressed regions, nutrient-deficient regions, and so on. But you can imagine there are a ton of environmental factors that influence the performance of a plant and the performance of a microbe in that environment. And so we perform research all over the world and try to select the best microbes and pair them with the best soils and help them succeed in those environments. You know, sometimes it works really well, other times it's more challenging, but that's one of the reasons we continue to develop new products as we go. I think the exciting thing about what we've seen in the U.S. and now as well in Australia is that in addition to the 85,000 or so acres in Australia that we've planted of treated seed, we're now beginning to roll out our marketplace and some of the other initiatives that we have in the U.S. that essentially can support growers, whether they're using our microbes or not, our infield agronomy, some of the other digital tools, and so on. So as the company's mission continues to grow, getting these technologies and opportunities to international markets always has a little bit of a delay, of course. And the company's changing so fast right now that we're seeing unique opportunities pop up all over the place. But I'm really excited to be here for the first time and kind of see how the work we're doing in Australia is continuing to advance.
Yeah, I should mention that Dan literally flew in this morning and landed at 7 a.m. So we need to give him at least three more beers and see if he stays awake.
That's right. No idea what time it is. So.
It is exciting to see you guys here. I mean, we use Indigo often as an example of a company that embraces, for at least from the outside, a lot of the principles of startups around changing business models rapidly depending on kind of what's working and what's not and what the market needs. And so being able to really pivot in a way that a big company wouldn't be able to do. From your perspective on the inside, how much of that has been kind of the stages of the strategy that was laid out from the beginning versus a let's just figure it out and see what's working and try all the things?
I think it's certainly a bit of both. I mean, our founder and our CEO are both incredibly ambitious people who see a future that many of us also still don't see in the same way that they do. But as the company has expanded and realized new opportunities, every time we uncover something, we also find that there's just huge opportunity on the other side of it. So when we launched Marketplace, one of the things that we didn't realize was that in order for growers to be able to market their grain to a unique buyer, it meant that you had to be able to help them store that grain. They had to be able to hold it to the right point in the year when the buyer could accept it. A lot of growers don't have storage capabilities right now on their farms. And so we actually stood up a whole business around on-farm storage to try to figure out ways to provide storage to growers that didn't have it. I mean, that's, you know, if you can sell your grain 2 months later, there are huge opportunities for financial gains. Similarly, we developed a trucking and logistics business because for the same reason. We realized there were huge inefficiencies as we started getting into marketplace around the actual physical delivery of grain between the buyer and the seller. So those are, you know, two examples of things where I don't think we realized that those were such opportunities until we got into the business of marketing grain. But many of them, I think, we're realizing how synergistic these components are. And that's true of some of our new work in carbon and other areas as well.
Yeah, so I want to jump to that, and I'm actually not entirely sure how separate or similar it is with the kind of digital work with TELUS Labs and with the kind of ag tech, digital space, robotics, et cetera, that you're doing. So tell us a little bit about your work there, and there's some opportunities, I think, for Australian startups and companies to get involved as well.
As a company, when I joined, we just recently stood up a part of the organization called Indigo Research Partners. Indigo Research Partners is really set up as a what we believe is the world's largest ag tech lab to be able to evaluate new technologies and deploy them and rapidly scale those that work and those that don't. For a lot of ag tech startups, it's really hard to prove the value of your technology to growers and to market proponents. You know, if you have a technology that you think might reduce input requirements, like say water, a new irrigation sensor by 20%, often you're stuck as a startup going kind of grower to grower, proving it to one and then proving it to the next, and so much time is spent with each one of those folks. And the grower is your only kind of way to demonstrate the value. But in the case of Indigo, with these research partner networks and the way we are spread out around the world, we're helping to deploy those kinds of technologies to evaluate their value proposition and then to rapidly scale the ones that work well. And so we've done that with a number of startup companies in infield sensors. You mentioned TELUS Labs. We realized as we started to work with them that satellite technology and the ability to evaluate yield and performance from space was going to be a game changer for us as a company. You know, so we looked at all the different companies that were out there, and that ultimately led to our acquisition of TELUS Labs. But startups, they play a huge role in our sort of our interaction with the space, and we're constantly trying to get more of them into our pipeline.
Cool. So tell us about the Terraton Initiative, which is a pretty big announcement that's made some waves in agriculture. How many of you guys have heard of the Terraton Initiative before reading the description of the meetup? Okay, four or five. Okay, great. So yeah, give us the kind of the background and the 101.
The Terraton Initiative is something that's been in the works for quite some time at the company. And we, since the beginning, had in our mission statement to try to think about how we can help growers improve the sustainability of their practices. And we'd thought for most of our time about that in terms of being able to reduce input requirements, to reduce the water use of products and so on. We started to realize, though, that soil and that, you know, the opportunity in carbon specifically was massive, but that it required pretty significant change from growers. So if you're a grower today and you modify your practices in certain ways, there are ways for you to significantly reduce your emissions while also potentially increasing the amount of carbon in the soil. And so Indigo's business has I think is really well set up to try to help provide that advice to growers for what practices to choose and how to optimize their management strategies, and then also through the crop marketing side of the business to try to help deliver more value to the grower by being able to market the grain that you have as sustainably grown with specific metrics. So we started to explore what are the ways that we could quantify those sustainability gains and then help pay growers. And over time, that has now led to us sort of realizing the opportunity in soil carbon and launching the Terraton Initiative, which is a global effort to try to reduce and sequester a trillion tons of carbon dioxide into agricultural soils. That is a massive number of tons for those that know a thing or two about carbon. All mankind emissions that exist in the atmosphere today that have increased since the Industrial Revolution are about a trillion tons. So our mission here is to say, is there some way that we could actually take the 3.9 billion acres of cropland around the globe and pull all of the CO2 that we have dumped into the atmosphere out of the atmosphere? It has a number of amazing benefits for farmers. You know, if you're able to increase carbon content in your soil, you reduce the resiliency of your crop. You reduce the ability for it to be affected by a number of different diseases and certainly drought, stress, and so on. So we think that kind of an ambitious goal is obviously huge in its scale, and it will require collaboration with a ton of different participants around the world to do. It's going to require a deeper understanding of how soil carbon increases, the kinds of management practices that farmers need to take on, and then also new markets that pay growers, rewarding them for increasing soil carbon. So one of the reasons I'm here in Australia this trip is to go visit the Carbon Farming Conference next week in Albury and learn how you all have been working on this for much longer than we have. You know, we think there's a lot to learn from what's going on around the world.
I want to ask, what's the response been like from growers? Because the talk around carbon farming and around the that consumers want this and the potential of farmers to farm regeneratively and more sustainably, that's something that's been talked about for a while. But in many cases, it hasn't been practical or financially viable. So have you guys kind of changed that conversation at all, or how is that changing in terms of the response of farmers and what it will actually mean in terms of their bottom line and their farming practices?
The interest from growers in the program that we're putting together has been immense. Since the time of the Terraton Initiative launch, which was about a month ago, we've actually had over 3 million acres of growers try to sign up for this program, which is more than all of the acres of treated seed that we've delivered across the globe since the start of the company. So it's a pretty crazy number for us to think about trying to help more acres than we've ever been on with these new initiatives. I think growers see this as an opportunity to gain additional revenue on top of what they've already been doing. You know, if we can make it low cost enough for them to participate and make the reward large enough, then it should be a no-brainer for them as well as for the buyers of these credits. So that's our hope.
What's the kind of thinking around both the economic viability in terms of like sampling and that it has to be there over time and you have to prove that the carbon was sequestered and continues to be sequestered? What's the pathway to actually be able to do that without spending more money than is economically feasible?
It's tough questions. I mean, it is certainly the thing that has caused these markets to break down in the past. You know, it's one thing to say I planted a tree and as long as I don't cut down that tree, it will continue to grow carbon in its size, and I can easily measure the diameter of the tree and know how much carbon is there. That's a very challenging thing to do in a system that is changing so frequently like agriculture, and recognizing as well that a single year of bad weather could potentially wipe out gains from previous, or that you could be doing everything right and still not increasing your carbon content. And we think there are a lot of technologies that can help us assess what a viable acre looks like versus a non-viable acre. We think recommending the right kinds of practices to growers and really being along the journey with them is a big driver here. And then we think making, just as you said, making the cost of sampling low enough by trying to only sample exactly where you need to and leveraging models in every point possible, essentially, to increase your ability to drive costs down. So all those things we think Indigo is uniquely positioned to do, but it's a big task ahead of us for sure, and it's not something that anybody has really figured out, I'd say.
Yeah, definitely, and hopefully we'll keep hearing like reflections from you after you leave Australia. I'd be curious what you learn here, and is it kind of as far ahead as you thought it might be, and what have you learned? One of the last questions I have before I kind of open it up to the audience is how you see the connection back to consumers and how important is that? Is this something that will be fully connected to consumers and pulled through like an organic certification that is really that kind of belief system from consumers pulling for and voting for the way they want the food system to be, or more of the kind of carbon market financial instruments focus upstream in that space?
Hopefully it's both. I mean, I would say if a grower is able to gain additional income from a market component here, somebody paying them to put carbon into the ground, and then they're also able to actually sell a grain that's been produced more sustainably that the consumer is interested in buying, the hope is that both of those sort of add up to produce a really viable opportunity for growers. I think it totally changes the game for growers as well. I mean, that if you think about for ages, growers have been thinking about optimizing around profitability, those that can think about it, but generally the proxy for that has been yield. So if I can improve my yield by X percent, then I have the best chance of being profitable in a market. And that works well when prices for crops are high, of course. I think those that are smarter often think about it more complex. You know, what are my input costs and my production levels? How do I balance profitability in the right way? If you introduce carbon, though, to that equation and you say carbon has a price to it, then a grower has this whole new lever on which to kind of optimize their operation. It might actually be more viable for you to have significantly lower yield, plant cover crops, do all kinds of other practices, and grow carbon as you're kind of growing a crop. And think about those two in tandem, which I think is just a really interesting economic kind of opportunity for a grower and one that hasn't been explored. It also means that all the cropping systems and genetics and breeds and varieties of everything we've developed have all been optimized on yield. we've never thought about, well, what if I increase plant root biomass by X amount, and what would that do to the genetic makeup? So, like, there are so many interesting opportunities on that side as well.
And that part is so important, that the metric has been yield, and that other metrics like carbon or other financial incentives are absolutely critical to kind of change the system. My last question, and then I'll open it up to the audience, is you guys have raised over $650 million and are arguably kind of one of the few ag tech startups that has built their own channel and on a path to kind of not get acquired, but perhaps list or have some other different kind of exit than many of the other ag tech startups. What has the response been from incumbents? Is it kind of collaborative in any way? Are you totally a threat? Are there kind of opportunities to partner? What's that dynamic like?
I would say we're the only company that's actually trying to kind of master every part of the agricultural system from inputs all the way through marketing. So any of the large incumbents that you talk to, they have a siloed view of the world that is just their piece of it. You know, so a Cargill, a Bungie, and ADM, right, just crop marketing. Kind of. So we might be disrupting that part of their business, and they might see us as a big threat. But they don't think of us as kind of a direct competitor in that sense. A Bayer, Monsanto, somebody on the input side, Syngenta, they might see us as a threat, but we take our treated seed product and put that treatment on top of their genetics. So we're not developing our own or looking for kind of off-market products or anything like that. So those are pretty collaborative relationships from that perspective. I think because we're so wide that nobody kind of sees that as a big threat. So it's an interesting spot to sit in from that perspective. Farmers Business Network may be one of the only other ones that is also kind of trying to take a wider lens there, but also just a very different business in its fundamentals. So we'll see how the carbing side develops and see how, kind of, who starts jumping into that space. But at the moment, it's been kind of we're racing against ourselves to try to see how quickly we can understand the whole system, which is a nice spot to sit, but it's a binary experiment from my view. Either we're wildly successful or this is a great time. So we'll see. I think we're gonna be wildly successful, but you never know.
Awesome. Well, I want to open it up to the audience. There's some pretty knowledgeable people that do work deeply in the ag sector here, so hopefully we'll get some good questions. Any questions? Yeah, sure. We'll start here.
In your business model, do you purchase land or you just partner with farmers?
Yeah, we don't currently purchase any land. We partner with farmers who either rent or own their land depending upon the setup. I would say we're starting to take a look at the role of institutional landowners more and more. For one reason, in the carbon markets, for example, the landowners ultimately are the ones that own the rights to the carbon that is being grown on the land, unlike a normal crop that a renter would own. And so it's a really interesting dynamic there. And if a landowner can actually help incentivize the renters of their land to increase their carbon in some way, that could be a really big way for us to get into the market quickly. I don't see us becoming a landowner, from that perspective, but we're starting to take a different view of ownership.
Hi, I'm Christy. I've got a twofold question. One is, I just want to understand better how you actually microbially treat seeds. Do you dip it or do you genetically modify it? And then let's say you're planting, I want to understand the cycle time to identify success or failure. Like, can you fail fast if you plant something in Australia and it's not right for these soils? What's that cadence for data?
Our seed treatment process right now is actually a coating. So we take a bare seed essentially and tumble it with a microbial product. Often that happens before the crop is being planted. And it might sit on the shelf for some period of time before it goes into planting. So different geographies, we do a slightly different process to try to modify it to how growers receive their seed and so on. So in the U.S., we centralize a lot of our seed treatment and then distribute bagged treated seed product directly to the growers. Here, the seed treatment happens much more often at the farm itself. There's no genetic modification in that process, so the grower can kind of bring whatever genetics package they want to the table, and then we'll put our treatment on top of that. And our treatment does not have any genetic modification in the microbes themselves, so that everything is sort of brewed organically from that perspective. The cycle for new product development, it can be quite rapid for us. We do a lot of work in lab and then in greenhouse and then in small plot trials and then in big field trials and then in commercial operations. So many of these things can happen quite rapidly and iteratively. Of course, the Mother Nature and her inherent cycle for a commercial product requires a sort of seasonal approach. And because we're doing a lot of our seed treatments today on the seed before it goes into the ground, we don't come back and do another treatment. But there are, of course, opportunities to explore that as well. You could think of microbes that are put on a foliar application, sprayed on the plant after it's been planted. So we're starting to explore those kinds of things as well, because we think there could be many opportunities to target the microbe to the event. At the beginning of the season, you don't know if there's going to be an outbreak of some disease or what the drought condition is going to be. So that opportunity to kind of treat in the moment, I think, is a really interesting one.
Richard Heath, I run the Australian Farm Institute now, but I used to be a farmer. So I want to expand on that, because that was going to be my question. So when I was farming, we did everything we could to build active soils. But the biggest problem we had was variability, both temporally and spatially. So we'd have paddocks with 3 or 4 different soil types. Every season's different in terms of how those soil types respond. So how quickly can you respond with a product that addresses the microbial need of the crop for that particular moment in time in that particular part of a paddock?
Yeah, it's a great question. I would say more and more we're starting to think about things as systems. So I would say it's actually not just the microbe, but it's everything else that you're doing. It's the management practices that you're implementing. So all of those things should ultimately be able to adapt as best they can to the individual environment. Just as you said, a unique soil type, a unique variety, a unique slope of the field in a specific spot might ideally call for a different mix of microbes, even in some senses, to optimize performance and try to decrease overall variability of yields. So, all of these things, I think, are future potentials for a more digital, site-specific form of agriculture. And we certainly believe in that same future. And I would say that mission of trying to think about how you would optimize each product for the specific site that it's in is certainly in our DNA. It requires a lot of other technologies, though, to also advance. Right now we have planting units that can modify planting density or planting depth depending upon certain soil conditions. This kind of a future would require that to the next level, right? We would need to be able to sense exactly what's happening at the individual spot and modify microbial mixtures sort of in real time. So I think it's certainly a direction that we'd like to go.
Hi, I'm Harvey Gaynor. I'm interested, Dan, in your journey from sort of the mechanical area of soft robotics through biology and into markets and services, really. So I'd like to hear a bit about that journey, that transition, how it's been for you, and then how you see we bring all of that together, and is there any one of those areas that has most opportunity or especially for leverage for the ag industry?
Yeah, so I started in a very technical side, technical roles as well. I had a first startup that we tried to found that was sort of more in line with my initial training. I started realizing personally that I was much more interested in the intersection of science and business and trying to communicate kind of between the two communities and try to help direct scientific development so that it could be impactful in a way that sometimes it can't because of those communication barriers between sides. For me, that meant as we started to develop this robotics business, starting to realize what opportunities that could bring to agriculture and trying to adapt our technology to meet those needs. There are so many opportunities in agriculture for new technologies to be developed and deployed, and a lot of opportunities as well to leverage technologies that have already been deployed in other sectors. For example, some of these challenges in soil sampling for carbon markets, a ton of money and research that has been poured into the mining industry. I was speaking to Salah about this a little earlier tonight. Being able to optimize the way that drill rigs work and sort of where they're pulling product out of the ground and the hydrology and geology of mapping soils underground and so on has happened in that industry, but yet we're still kind of in the dark ages from the soil sampling industry for agriculture still works the way it did 70 years ago. It hasn't changed at all. So I just feel like there are immense opportunities if we can attract scientists and technologists from other industries to come and help us solve problems within agriculture. That's true across engineering disciplines. It's true across financial disciplines and economics and so on. So we're trying to find those folks and help propel that change ourselves.
One of the things we talk about here in Australia in the ag tech community a lot is the opportunity for ag tech to attract a lot of new kinds of talent into agriculture. And we haven't really had this scale here for that to play out, to say, oh, there's this ag tech company that has hundreds and hundreds of employees and they've come from all these different disciplines. What's the Indigo company like? Do you have mostly people not from agriculture backgrounds? Is that kind of story playing out?
Yeah, it's nearly impossible to find an agriculture person in Boston. almost everyone is from some other industry before they've joined the company. Memphis is a little bit of a different story. I think that's one of the reasons we opened a commercial office in Memphis, is because we can attract the right kind of talent there that helps us, sort of helps keep us grounded. I spoke to somebody who was an early employee at Tesla once, and they said that on the day that Tesla went public, this guy who had spent 20 years in the automotive industry looked around as all these young, starry-eyed kids were kind of jumping around saying, we're going to build cars. And he realized no one here has ever built a car. Like, none of these people have ever seen an assembly line for a car. You know, and you can question whether Tesla is successful or not, but they have transformed the industry and done some really amazing things. You know, I think there's huge value in trying to, again, bring that talent from outside to reframe problems in a new way. I mean, you know, if you bring a data scientist who has never seen an agricultural field, but instead has looked at, you know, some completely different industry, and you bring them to agriculture, they just take a totally different lens on it. So we try to pair up backgrounds in different industries. I mean, in Boston, we're dominated by, there's a lot of consultants in Boston. We have a lot of those people. Tough life they live, but they build really good slides, so we leverage that a lot in our company. You know, and the biotech industry obviously is incredibly strong in Boston. A lot of great talent coming out of schools no one's heard of, like Harvard and MIT. And then we're constantly thinking about how do you think about problems in healthcare, for example, and the parallels that those might have to the data challenges that we have to solve in agriculture. How do you think about the scaling of technologies that has happened for internet companies, and could you bring that to agriculture? So I think we really benefit from all those perspectives.
Thank you. Diane Hockey, and I'm actually a farmer, currently trialing some indigo crop on the Liverpool Plains. And I'm so excited by the initiative. I think it's the first time as a farmer we've had interaction with a company that gives us an opportunity to actually end up with a better economic result out the other end. And agriculture in Australia is desperate to try and get that better profitability into our businesses. The drought's sort of knocking us about a bit, but I just think there's a wonderful future for Indigo in Australia, and I support you wholeheartedly and glad to be on board. So thanks, Dan, for coming out.
This last question was not a plug for Indigo Ag. She really was an audience member. And we ended the night on this comment and positive note for the future. I hope you enjoyed the episode. Thanks again to Grow Love Project for recording and producing it, and to SproutX for sponsoring the meetup.
Thank you for joining us on another episode of AgTech So What. You can stay up to date with the latest episodes and news at agtechsowhat.com. And as always, if you have any feedback or other guests to recommend, we'd love to hear from you. Just hop on the website and leave us a comment or send us a message. Finally, if you like what you're hearing, and we hope you do, please share the podcast with a friend or leave us a review on iTunes or wherever you get your podcasts. Thanks again for listening. Catch you next time.